Hello guys, welcome to Unapologetic. Today is going to be an interesting session for two reasons. Firstly, we're recording in a park. That's a first for us. Usually it's recording at a house, like inside, but it's nice outside, so we thought we'd take advantage of it. And, you know, public spaces are part of sociology and the way we interact with it. So, yeah, you have two very bright colored haired people sitting in a park discussing about queerness. So that'll be an interesting journey. And the second reason why it's interesting is today we have one of my former teachers and a current teacher as academic figure and, you know, an individual queer person here with me, Alex. She can do some introductions for herself, and yeah, I'm so happy to have her as a guest.
Thank you for having me on. I'm extremely grateful to share the space with you and excited for what it is we talk about. All of our conversations are always very compelling and interesting, so, and especially in the park as of today, very lively, lots of social interactions to take in as well. But to just very briefly introduce myself, I'm Alex, my pronouns are she, her. I'm originally from the States, and my undergraduate studies, but my academic background, were in sociology and linguistics, namely as those intersected, so sociolinguistics, sort of how language facilitated social interaction, but also how social interaction influenced language. And then I spent a little bit of time in the private corporate sector, and then moved back into academia, where I pursued a research master's at the UVA in social sciences, and my thematic foci were in anthropology and sociology. My methodological training is in qualitative research, namely ethnography, and my research was on how Anglican Franciscan nuns establish subjecthood, with a particular interest in their gender and sexuality, so how they kind of come to understand themselves, know themselves as legible social actors in religious life, and how they sort of hold their gender and sexuality in that. So I'm excited to get into it and see what it is we talk about.
Thank you, Alex, for that introduction. The purpose of today's podcast is to have a relaxed conversation, as we try most of our discussions to be, about our stance in the world. I think sometimes, even though sociology, you know, tries to be in the macro and in the macro, today we really want to, you know, settle it to two individuals and our experiences with the world and how we interact with it, because we forget that, like, society is built from those small interactions that become larger ones, and, you know, focusing on how these have ripple effects from me interacting with other teachers and students and who are queer or not, and how we are perceived in the classroom or on the media, and how Alex sees herself, you know, in the same viewpoint from a different perspective. I was personally born and raised in Mexico, and she was born and raised in the United States. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, literally we are neighboring countries, and how our understanding of queerness as people in school and in academia from very different positions have interacted with that term and comes to term with our own identity, but with what we project and write in our papers, in the way that Alex teaches, in the way that I am receptive towards her her knowledge and her interactions towards other teachers. And yeah, and the second part of the podcast will be also in relation to how me as a Gen Z, I was more exposed to this aspect of queerness and my journey through it from being in school and, like, the pandemic, and Alex as more of an adult, I would say, as an older person than I am, experiencing it with her generation and her context in the US. So yeah, that's what we're gonna be talking about. As always, please remember, and I will reiterate this at the end of the podcast, these are our own perspectives. The purpose of this podcast is to stimulate discussion. If there's anything you agree or disagree with, that you like, that you would think about or would like to reflect upon, you can send a message to our Instagram. We are at unapologeticbysec. And yeah, we really hope you enjoyed this podcast, and if you have any other ideas for future episodes, send us, or any feedback on previous episodes, don't shy away from sending a message. So yeah, the first we're going to talk about our positionality. Alex, you can start first.
Sure. That was beautiful. It was a beautiful setup. Already having broached a bit of our positionality, you make me so proud. You make me so proud as your teacher. My positionality, as mentioned, I'm from the States. And my education is largely in Western countries as well. So I do check that and the privilege afforded and associated with that. In terms of my positionality as an academic, I tend to lean very much into kind of like, you know, you did mention that it's more of a colloquial and an informal conversation, so I'll try not to throw on too much jargon, but but that said, in terms of my positionality in academia, like, theoretically and epistemologically, I'm very much leaning into social constructivism, so just, like, leaning into social interactions and how things are enacted and how things come to be through socializing and socialization, and how these things are produced and reproduced. And then let's see what else. I am a queer person, and so many of my outlooks are informed by queer theory and queer perspectives. And I also align with decolonial studies and perspectives as well. And, you know, otherwise, I'm an Aquarius, so there's that. That informs a lot. That's a bit of my positionality. I'm sure we can unpack it further, just the very idea of how all these intersections of our identities, kind of how they move in and out, how they influence or inform our perspectives. I imagine we'll practice it all throughout, but that's what comes to mind at the top of what I'd mentioned. And then, of course, my age. I am a millennial. I like to think I'm a cusp, but not really. I'm a little above a cusp. But, you know, definitely have my own respective journey into queerness, both professionally and personally. So definitely look forward to sharing and situating that as well. But tell me a little bit about your positionality, babes. What's your deal?
Okay, so where to start? I think I'm still developing an academic positionality, because I'm seeing courses, you know, what they have to offer and the different viewpoints. I would definitely say I'm very involved in Marxism right now. And I was very much exposed initially to queerness itself through movies. Like, even growing up with my parents, there were things that, you know, were available to us, and it was spoken, you know, as the phrase would say, at the dinner table. But I didn't have a lot of queer people in my life. I remember I had a student, one of my fellow classmates, and she came out as bi like 7 years ago or something. Yeah. And that was the first, like, very personal, very near me. And I was so excited. I was like, damn. And we had a group chat for, like, her protection squad. Nobody was going to say anything, but it was just like, you know, sure. we were all going to be there for her.
Yeah.
And then half of that group ended up being gay themselves, so that was really interesting. I think that was my first interaction with queerness. And from then on, I just guess it was people around me. It didn't really ring a bell towards who I was as a person. Eventually, I became very invested in Twitter and feminism, which I think was also a big gateway. Yeah. Personally, it was a very good way to get experiences, because I try to follow people from many backgrounds. It was academics, it was sex workers, it was decolonial activists, people from around the world. On the downside, Twitter can become an echo chamber, so a lot of what I was receiving, both from a feminist perspective and queerness, was it came from a lot, like a place from anger, which is 100% valid, but it became into a lot of hate, mm-hmm. and I stopped resonating with people that, you know, on so many terms were radical in not a way that transforms society, but rather wishes to, I don't know, abolish people in very literal senses.
Yeah, I so deeply resonate with what you're saying as well, because in terms of my queerness, I myself never really even came out. Coming out, the very act of coming out, that could be a whole podcast conversation in of itself, right? I am of the opinion that, you know, it shouldn't necessarily be obligatory or compulsory. That said, I also didn't really have representation. So I grew up in the South, in the States, and it was highly conservative. And so I identify as bisexual, and I didn't see any of that representation. Truth be told, I just thought everyone thought women and femmes and were beautiful. Like, yeah. I was of that working assumption, come to find out. That's not a universalism, I don't understand.
What?
And so I didn't really come into my queerness until later in life. And yeah, I always felt feelings of difference. And I wasn't quite sure. I didn't have the language for it. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know what to do with that or how to hold it or how to parse it. Some of that I can attribute to my neurodivergence as well. I was, diagnosed in that. But, yeah, it's been a whole journey for myself also to kind of, uncover. But what you said, too, about, anger, unfortunately, that mine also kind of, there was a genesis or an origin in anger. That was my origin story, I guess. That was my
villain arc.
Exactly, yeah, it was a villain arc. But, you know, in some ways, I feel like I almost want to practice, forgiveness for the both of us too in saying that, because we can now, hindsight is 2020. Yeah. I think I had to release a lot of anger for feeling that I had to suppress myself or be smaller or, you know, not really know how to make sense of my difference. I think there was almost grief more so, mm-hmm. and that kind of presented as anger.
Yeah.
That said, I like you. Yeah, it was angry. I was, and I also had a lot of anger around religion, because that was a really big factor in my life as well, and suppressed my sexuality. And that's not to say that for everything, but that was sort of how I experienced religion. And now that I have a bit more perspective, I mean, I study religion, so I find that I have a better relationship with it. But yeah, I think the anger was more just out of grief than anything else. But I definitely lost perspective there for a while. It had kind of collapsed, and while I would preach being open, which is what I associated with queerness, I myself felt like I wasn't
open enough.
Yeah, or I wasn't being as open, because if someone were to try to dissent or say anything in opposition to what I was saying, I'd be like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You sit down. You sit down. Because I felt like I had, in my life, experienced so much of that up until that point. I wasn't going to take it
anymore.
Yeah. But, you know, I think queerness and queer theory can mean so many things, but I think that, being open to dialogue, or rather, you know, queerness, I think, helps facilitate an openness to dialogue, or at least, space for difference and divergence, and celebrating that. And so I've come into my own journey in that, too. But it's interesting how we both already, it's like, oh, yeah, some similarities, and that's unfortunate, but hey, you know, we've channeled that anger in productive ways now.
Yes, and what I find very interesting for me was that my anger stemmed more from the patriarchy in Mexico than it did from my queerness, but then by extension, that related to my, sort of manifested through my queerness.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, living in a country where 11 women are killed every day, and religion is also a massively part of the country, not of my life. I was not raised religiously, but it definitely, you start seeing men, at least I started seeing men as the pinnacle of violence, or that's where it stems from, and that's where my anger came from.
Yeah,
I think slowly people in my life started making me realize, okay, you know, hold your horses. I was not even engaging in conversations that were different to mine, or even people similar to me was like, no, you know, I'm the only right person.
Yeah.
What I think was different for me in a sense was that, from what Alex is saying, is that at the time that I came out, to my community, a lot of people, I'm not saying because of me, but at the same time, a lot of people started communally coming out. So I could see representation from people my own age coming to terms with whoever they were, you know, gender-wise, sexuality-wise. My gender experience came much, 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 much later in a very different sense and from a very different place. But what I really like is the word hindsight, you know, like being able to see in retrospect. I don't know, the way that we were able to build a community with online means, you know, like it was during the pandemic, most of it. I was, I think I was like 15, 16 when this started dawning on me. And I can assume that's an early age compared to people that realize they're queer, I don't know, in their 30s, in their 40s. So I was very, very grateful and lucky to have a very supportive family, a very supportive community, teachers where this dialogue, I don't know what happened, like would discuss it and amplify it. And we can talk about this, which is also interesting, and it just dawned on me, the linguistic aspect of it, because in Spanish, you know, words are gendered. So that brought upon another layer. And I had a teacher who was very much like similar to you in an activist sense, but also aware of queerness outside of herself. I don't even know her personal experience, but she highly encouraged using diverse language. We substitute with the X an O or an A, which are O masculine and A feminine. O is used as the plural in Spanish and as many other gendered languages. There is a binary, so when using an E or an X to replace other gendered endings, this was also part of my academic upbringing. I did the IB and I persisted on writing all of my assessments with that language. And my teacher was very supportive of that. I mean, she did it in her presentations, in her grading. And I think that that environment, as privileged as it was, you know, it's middle high class, and it's people that were generally from backgrounds where this was accepted and where religion wasn't a big part of it. You know, suppression came from elsewhere, but it wasn't always from very conservative backgrounds. So we had a place to express ourselves, and school was also a safe space for it. Mexico itself as a country is not, but maybe you can reflect more upon this, and then we can go back to the linguistic aspect and our countries.
Yeah, definitely. So first of all, how very dare you? You bring up linguistics, of course. I love it. I'm so here for that conversation because it is interesting in of itself. But yeah, actually, to go back to what you had mentioned as well, feminism was also a bit my gateway too, because I also came into like the field of queer studies a bit later in my academic professionalization. But it was sort of founded and rooted in intersectional feminism, and you know, kind of just trying to get an understanding of the patriarchy, but the patriarchy being just one of those very like abstract but very real reified oppressors, and then kind of developing an understanding around what all of those were. And and I also wanted to speak to though what you mentioned about, you know, when you came out and, you know, others kind of following suit maybe a little bit. I mean, that's you were so very modest. You were like, well, that couldn't have been because of me, you know. But I think we'll probably speak to this too, because we had intended to talk like social media as well. But representation, although, you know, it shouldn't be the only factor for risk of being performative, it is important. And so I think that's, you know, I had already kind of mentioned coming out, like I think there are like dualities and dimensions to that. A benefit of coming out is that it can give others momentum, it can give others visibility and support that they need to then feel comfortable and confident in coming out. And this just made me think linguistically about the word queer as well. And I think queer is in of itself is it's queer. It's like there's a meta nature to it, right? Where it just, it's a lot of things, and it can encompass a number of things, and everyone's queerness can look a bit different. But that said, I think everyone can hold queerness individually, but sort of as you mentioned, queerness is also in interacting and connecting and relating. And so I think, at least for myself, how I operationalize queerness is that it's community is like rooted in it. It's fundamental. And so, you know, that was just beautiful to hear you speak to that. Like once you can come out, then you can build a community around that. And people can kind of then find their community. And that's just, that's a beautiful thing. Sociologically, interesting as well.
Before we go to the linguistics, yeah. just to respond to what you were saying.
Yeah, please.
I think one of the other benefits of not only you coming out, but other people discussing their queerness or their curiosity or even delving onto these topics is that you find intersections with other people that are not in your circle, because I was very much in an enclosed bubble.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, online, that gave me the step towards, you know, this is another link, but I was also not as active in other sorts of activism, but in climate crisis activism. Mm. And there I met, you know, people of color, some indigenous people who were also queer. Mm. And it's like, you know, there's steps to this that, you know, once you tip your toes, you kind of just not sink, because that's negative. You know, you just start swimming.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a really nice way to meet people. There's much more depth. And I think Alex would agree than like, oh, my God, being gay is the best. not only because of the discrimination that comes with it, but also because of the agency that people have to create harm because they use these labels as, like, I don't know, excuses to promote other types of violence.
Yes, of course.
But this happens with all sorts of hierarchies, and it's present in all sorts of societies.
Yeah, 1,000%. I think, unfortunately, there is just a fear around difference, especially for those in the majority or for those with consolidated power. And so, while, of course, you and I could both sit here and be like, gay is great. Absolutely. there are definitely complexities that range in violence being a very real one. And so it can definitely be challenging, but all very rewarding as well. Oh, there was another point you had spoken to. Ah, well, social media. So, yeah, that's my neurodivergence of it all. But social media, I mean, just as you had said, like, it, I think, because it is boundless, it can genuinely open our perspective, especially when, just as you and I said, like, we didn't have that representation. It can sort of afford us that, with, of course, the acknowledgement that it can, in fact, be an echo chamber.
So,
being cognizant of that and having reservations, or rather doing our due diligence, right? Especially as trained academics, like, cross-referencing things. But I digress. I think it's social media can be such a powerful tool to afford that representation, that visibility, but also for education, to educate, increase accessibility of information, such that then people can have these conversations, you know, even if, you know, they are assured in their identity or don't know. I mean, it can just be a space where they can pick up their phone and kind of take it in on their terms, and then hopefully engage in conversation with others to kind of further that thinking and further develop it. You know, it's also, I think, dismantles the gatekeeping and the consolidation of that information.
Yes, and the experiences.
Exactly, right, and the experiences, because it shouldn't belong to just the few, or it shouldn't belong to just, you know, if afforded privilege, or, you know, it's been amazing too, like that, I mean, honestly, I credit TikTok too with kind of helping foster or facilitate my sexual identity and development. Like, TikTok knew I was gay before I did, you know, so.
Yeah, the algorithm knew.
The algorithm knows. But so I mean, that in of itself is just a beautiful thing. Now, of course, that said, there are dichotomies to this, right? So, like, it can be good, but then also there can be issues, speaking of the algorithm in of itself. But I thought to speak to that as well. But linguistically, let's get into it. We got to speak to it, you know, very briefly. You mentioned that it's something I think about often, like, and, you know, the Dutch language as well. Like, I mean, there are so many languages.
Do you speak Dutch?
I do not.
Okay.
I'm bitches. But but like the Dutch language, I've spoken to colleagues and comrades who are Dutch, and they're non-binary, and they kind of were explaining to me the pronouns and how they sort of have to get creative with the language to kind of do that. And then, you know, as in Spanish as well, I mean, you know, far better than me, but peripherally in my studies of Spanish, I've come to learn about X as opposed to O and A. And so, you know, identifying as chicken X and things of that nature. So, it's an amazing thing. But yeah, it's interesting how language in of itself can both afford and constrain in many ways, but it's an opportunity for creativity, which queerness fundamentally kind of helps facilitate that line of thinking, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. and that's those narratives and ideologies. So yeah, it's all so super interesting. But we're socialized into this language, right? So that's sort of how the binaries are quite literally programmed into us and then reproduced. So we kind of, for ourselves, then have to come to kind of terms with this, and there are many theories around like how much language constrains or influences thought, and you know there's something we said that it does, but our thinking can move beyond that. We don't necessarily have to have words for something to know
that it exists.
Yeah. It's just a matter of communicating it and then figuring out ways to communicate that, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you know, and how we go about doing that. And so, yeah, all super interesting. So I will refrain from speaking any further to it because
no,
I could talk about it at length.
I'm just thinking about all the like ways that this relates to me.
Oh, I love it.
So you built the perfect like timeline in my head. So firstly, there was the whole TikTok, you know, internet, my friends coming out. And then I decided to create an online magazine with my best friend about anything that young people wanted to write about. So the point was to give not a voice but a platform for people to voice their many opinions on social topics, and they weren't necessarily things that were of our positionality, but it's more so, you know, people for I think it was 16 to 23 years old, 25 years old, to be able to express themselves. And he wrote, we were both editors, and he wrote one piece and I wrote another piece. We would sometimes like alternate, but my first piece was, I think it was titled Todas, Todos, Todes, which means everybody, everybody, everybody.
Oh my God.
Which is feminine, masculine, gender neutral. And to me, the purpose of this piece that I wrote, I'll see if I can try to find it to share with Alex.
Please do.
And translate it. But the point of this was to talk about how we must create different worlds through the words that we use, because they, I don't know, shape our understanding of the world. And I realized when I didn't have non-binary people close to me, let alone friends, but when I realized that I made it a habit to use the E, it was very uncomfortable. And I was like, wow, I kind of like this. It's very scary. It's very untrained territory from things we've seen online. It's a different language, you know, like I would say the US or the West or English itself has like a big monopoly on the media, because you know it's an accessible language to a lot of countries.
Sure, it's a lingua franca for sure.
Yeah, but understanding from like, you know, countries that have, correct me if I'm wrong, people, but I think Polish, for example, has gendered verbs, and that to me is like, okay, that's another level. You know, you're not just doing nouns and pronouns, you're going to the verbs.
The very actions.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was talking with a friend who really likes linguistics, and she was like, well, there's also another layer to it, because when you use the gender neutral way of like changing Polish, you're referring to an it. So a person becomes an object, and it's like, okay, you know, what is that to a person? You know, I think when I wrote that article, I wasn't aware that I myself was going to go through that gender process much later, but it wasn't even for the non-binary people that it would eventually be in my life, so much as it was, gender is not binary and neither is our understanding of the world. And I think gender is a way to tackle the binariness of like good, evil, black, white, however we may see like man, woman,
right,
to break that. And once we take that step and really commit to it, because it is a commitment, it's something I do every day. In my head I have to change, switch around, and it sort of starts becoming natural to people in my close environment that are Spanish speakers. It's still strange, you know, speaking with an E, it sounds like a deformed, butchered up language that was created by fairies, because the E makes it like, ooh.
Yeah.
And it's understanding like, okay, if I want to exist in a world, in a linguistic world, I'm going to have to make an effort. And when everything was so automatic, it's like, okay, I exist on a non-automatic level anymore. I exist on a conscious level.
Absolutely.
And that's hard. It's exhausting at times, but it's also liberating.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my two cents.
Oh my God, I love it. I completely agree. You dropped so much dope shit. Who do I speak to first? First of all, yes, I would like to see that piece. That sounds incredible. So amazing. But yeah, I mean, and it's so interesting what you'd said, you know, about that kind of almost discomfort that you experienced, mm-hmm. Or maybe even confrontation.
Yeah.
In making that change for yourself, because it's true. I mean, even I find myself in that too. There are still some things where I am sort of confronted with, you know, internalized homophobia or internalized compete, and language can be part of that.
Yeah.
But I keep going back to the word queer, because there's so much. Language is power. I'm mm-hmm. of the opinion that language is power, yeah. And it's really how we can connect, and you know, it doesn't always have to be oral, but like you know, in terms of signing or anything, but just like communicating, how that's how we convey our realities to one another. That's how we understand each other and how we transmit all this information. Anyway, in terms of language, it's just, it's so interesting to think through queer and how, like, I think rebellion is also at the root of queer, so community mm-hmm. and rebellion, mm-hmm. and so that very act of queering language, you know, where you're changing it to the E, and it can feel uncomfortable. I mean, that's, you know, that is enacting queerness. It's that rebellion, but also an assertion, you know, like mm-hmm. finding your place and using language to support you, because I am also, even to position myself as a linguistic scholar, I am a descriptive position in the sense that I think language is how we make of it, is what we make of it. You know, it can exist in systems such that we have, like, you know, an informed understanding, mm-hmm. Or like we have a baseline understanding of one another. But as long as we can understand each other, language has served its purpose.
Yeah.
I don't subscribe so much to like enforcing gender roles or policing language or things of that nature.
Yeah.
Anyway, I appreciate you sharing that, because there's also vulnerability in that, right? Where it's like for myself too, like for a long time, I also didn't even afford myself my queerness because I just thought I wasn't queer enough. Yeah. I don't know what threshold I was holding up myself against, but I didn't think I was. And so, you know, when I did start coming into it, I wanted to get it almost like perfect, if you will, you know, and we're all a work in progress, but I just think there's something to that, right? It's like coming into yourself. And that's also beautiful in of itself, that process. And there's so many dimensions. It's not just in terms of how we present ourselves, but how we speak of ourselves and how we mm-hmm. speak with one another. And there's power in that too. In, like I said, language is power. And so when we make these changes, you know, if people take that up, if it informs or influences these interactions, then mm-hmm. it can start conversations, it can further thinking and create very real changes. You know, it's kind of what you were talking about at the beginning too, the micro to macro, mm-hmm. right? There's this, I guess, fluidity that moves between the two, all of which I think is, not all of which, but a lot of which I think can be facilitated by language. It's so, so interesting and hard. Yeah.
I would definitely say it's hard entering Twitter or any social media account and finding boomers being like, you know, they're more defensive of the, what is it called? The Royal Spanish Dictionary.
Oh, for fuck's
sake. Like, they're like, no, please don't touch my beautiful language. And it's like, bro, if I asked you to name every single word and spell it correctly, you couldn't. So you're not upholding an institution you yourself can vouch for. So
preach.
And remind, like, going back to this language's power, I wanted to write a big piece, a final essay on for school, for the IB, about how Spanish, and this applies to other languages, was a colonial project.
Oh, yeah.
So how gender was enforced through colonization of the language and of the mind. Sadly, I wasn't able to carry it out because there was very limited information and also very limited time, I think. I'm not sure what I want to write my thesis on, but, you know, there's time to think about that. But definitely having time to look at the resources and, you know, see movements across the world in different languages. You know, like, how do you tackle gender in a genderless language or in a completely gendered language?
Absolutely.
I think that's extremely interesting. But to me, this historical aspect, this decolonial, you're good. This decolonial, like, side to it of how you create a binary to create control, and how we want to release ourselves from that self-control and from that external control enforced by authorities, you know, gender stereotypes, you know, promote capitalism, right. Families being reproduced, babies being born. I definitely think that's incredibly important and part of the nuances that we must expose ourselves to. And something that I came across when the Black Lives Matter protest was happening is like, race has so many dimensions in the U.S. as it will have many different dimensions in Mexico and their neighboring countries. So I cannot even imagine what that has in the western part of Africa or in Southeast Asia. I don't know, like there's so many understandings of race, so I cannot even begin to imagine linguistics, you know, like dialects, indigenous languages, how people enunciate or pronounce certain things.
Yes.
So that's an even another dimension of how queerness is expressed very differently and understood very differently. Relating again back to language, there was a whole movement of wanting to write the word queer, but in Spanish, like the non-anglicized version, which was a C, a U with the two dots, a cum laude, an umlaut.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Then I and R, so it's queer. I personally, I think it's cool, but I got the English version tattooed.
Hey, gorgeous.
I like the English version, and I can even say maybe to generations much older than Alex, you know, this was used as a slur, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago. So that's, you know, it's coming to terms with that generational breach and how it must affect some people hearing that word. And for us, it's more used in our daily language. So that's also, you know, there's the colonial aspect, there's their age gap, there's the historical differences to think about, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like in the same way that we were talking about visibility, I think language can sort of serve a similar function in the sense that, like, the more we talk about something, the space it can afford or the thinking it can open up for people to take up for themselves or otherwise. And, you know, language as almost, the dictionary or, like, you know, the what is otherwise the prescriptive sort of, like, outlook and perspective on language. So very much prescribing, wanting to systematize it, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find it so interesting whenever I'm confronted with that, especially, you know, those boomers that just get so fucking upset about pronouns and stuff, as if they've never used they, them in their fucking life.
Not only that, that's funny. It's like, how would you refer to a group of strangers over there? Bless you.
Thank you.
You'd say, like, you know, they're a group of students. The funniest bit to me is when people say, I'm against pronouns. It's like,
oh my god,
are you against language? Bless you.
Right? Like, have you never? Are you just fundamentally against pronouns now? Are you just anti-pronouns now? You're just not going to use them ever again. Just renouncing them.
Renounce yourself. You know, like, wow, that's, you know, abolish gender. You're doing something for everybody.
There you go. Right? Yeah. Like, if you're then just gonna rebel against pronouns, go off, queen. Yes. Like, down with gender. You know. But yeah, it's just, it's incredible to me when people regard language as though it's something that's static, and it's not. I mean, it's living, it's dynamic, it's relational, it's enacted, it's spoken into existence, and it's how we relate to one another. And so I just, to me then, of course it would change and things would get different. And while I can understand one, like, needing to grieve change or maybe take issue with change, I, for my part, when I was in my angry phase, in my early phase, it wouldn't be doing this. But now I try to more just, like, lead with curiosity and say, like, okay, I see this upsets you. Like, you know, what is it about it? Like, because more often than not, it's not about pronouns. It's about them feeling confronted. It's them feeling challenged, you know, or maybe feeling uneducated or whatever it is. You know, it might be an insecurity that it's tapped into, and it's important to talk about that. So it doesn't get in the way of the bigger project at hand, which is to dismantle and talk about these various systems of oppression, which, going back to what you had said, too, about language, I mean, language, English especially, like, it's a product of colonialism, or gender, really, is a product of colonialism, the gender binary. If we look in nature, if we look in indigenous cultures, I mean, there's so much gender diversity, and that existed before. You know, I mean, this is not new. None of this is really new. And So it's incredible how that was suppressed, oppressed, eliminated, exploited, and rendered invisible.
Yeah.
Such to the point, like, that we sit now, that we were saying that we didn't have that representation. But
yeah.
It's there. It surrounds us, even in nature. And so it's just, it's very interesting. Like, I don't know, this is another part that I've been trying to sort of think on for myself, that I don't know that there's something fundamentally wrong with, like, binaries per se, and that, like, okay, two things can exist.
Mm-hmm.
Two things can be true, though, is
yeah.
the thing. One should not have to discount the other or discredit the other. And I think that's a risk of binaries, is that
yeah.
it becomes one or the other.
Yeah.
But, you know, two things can be, can exist, but that shouldn't mean, again, to further that point, that other things can't exist.
Yeah.
There should be space for all and not an upholding or a hierarchy or a regard of another. So, yeah, it's just, it's all very interesting. Oh, and I will say one thing I didn't mention about my own respective positionality is I am white, and even though I have heritage from Mexico as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just, in terms of my decolonial studies and things, that comes from my academic profession, but I definitely encourage listeners to look up decolonial scholars in themselves as well. Bell Hooks, Audre Lorde, Kimberly Crenshaw, Patricia Hill Collins, you know, to kind of also further this as well and think through with us. But yeah, it's especially indigenous cultures, just like you said. I mean, there is just so much richness and so much gender diversity that it's a shame that the binary was projected and imposed on that, such that then we're now having to come back into it.
Yeah.
And then to regard, and like I said, I mean, that even in of itself, language is not static. There was language for that, for how they experience gender, that was then snuffed out, if you will, or replaced. And so that's change in of itself, like language is changing. But anyway, yeah, language is not something to be put in museums, and even museums don't return things to people where they belong.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just like, it's just, that's so interesting to me, the boomers and their fucking, their anger around language, as though it's tip of the iceberg.
It definitely is. I could not agree more. I would continue responding to your points, but I realize we are 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So I think something good would be to wrap up by discussing two things. First of all, I can briefly mention mine, but I want to hear yours as a teacher and as an academic, your understanding or positionality, performance, necessity to be a teacher as a queer person and as an academic.
Yeah.
And maybe wrap up the episode, like the last two things. Oh, there's a beautiful bumblebee. We're both looking at it. Maybe some questions or reflections for people to, I don't think about after they listen.
Definitely.
And as a note to Orly, who will be posting it, or Messiah, that's we'll thank the team at the end, but I'm not sure who posted on Spotify, but we can both like send links to articles, names of people mm-hmm. that can relate to the topics that we're talking about. In my regard, I think having both young and old people, because I've had from both sides of the age dimension and social grasp of the world,
mm-hmm.
be open to gender and to sexuality and to queerness in the way that they teach, in the way that they approach. And I'm very thankful that in sociology, pronouns are asked. It's optional, of course, to respond, but for people that are willing to and able to, it creates a space for mm-hmm. them to, I don't know, share them, and that there are continuously more communities that we try to hold ourselves as much accountable as we can
mm.
with people we know, with people that we don't know, and yeah, understand that even in the most vulnerable spaces, there are going to be hierarchies, and to understand, should we tackle them? Should we respond to them? Should we accept them and better them?
Yeah.
That's also, I guess, a question for the end.
Right? Definitely. You know, I think because I'm almost, and this is literally just, this struck me right here in the moment, but hierarchies, they can happen, but I think what's even more important to interrogate is a power differential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think sometimes hierarchies can exist. I often think of the teacher student dynamic. Yeah. You know, I think even as hard as sometimes we try to dismantle those, the very nature, like even where we're standing in the space, can sometimes portray or, I don't know, even visually index a hierarchy. And then, of course, across cultures as well. You know, I mean, there's different respect or regard or maybe authority assigned to someone, which can then sort of have the effects or sort of perpetuate a hierarchy, or can establish a hierarchy. That said, it is really about attention to that power differential. Like, even if this is maybe afforded to me, if I'm noticing a hierarchy, just for instance in the classroom, how can I bring it to attention? How can I, you know, in my capacity, try to remedy that and navigate any power differential, especially if that power is assigned to me for whatever reason. But yeah, I mean, and what you mentioned about pronouns, it's interesting because, I mean, so I've been teaching now for about 3 years, and when I first started and we were doing introductions, thinking about how we wanted to do our introductions in our first weeks of classes, our course coordinators give us a lot of space and autonomy to kind of dictate how it is we want to facilitate that. And I talked to a lot of colleagues about it, like what information did we want to request to be included in introductions. And I was insistent that I would include pronouns. Some of my other colleagues were a bit reticent or had more reservations about that because of maybe what it could elicit, or, you know, perhaps even making, you know, some students uncomfortable from the start. And while, just as you said, like, there's something we said about it being optional, I'm of the opinion that, you know, we need to try to dismantle the idea that there are standard or mainstream pronouns or just assumptions. Basically, just like dismantling assumptions. And so by not speaking of it, that's how these things can be reproduced and can then exist as working assumptions. And then if we're not talking about it, then we're not interrogating, we're not holding awareness or accountability of things. And so, you know, even if it does, I thought to myself, it did make it uncomfortable perhaps for someone, then I wanted to then put in place community guidelines or to kind of help co-create a classroom space where we can talk about that. Like, oh, okay, if it brought up some discomfort, well, let's unpack that. Let's get into that. Like, why is it, you know? And kind of work through that together, you know? Because, oh, and this is reminding me of something you had said earlier, too. Something about queerness I've also found is that, you know, there's something we said about being comfortable with being uncomfortable. As related to rebellion as well. It's just like trying to call into question these things and, you know, try to think more creatively, celebrate difference, hold space for difference. But anyway, as related to the classroom, I was insistent on pronouns, that everyone should share their pronouns, even if it was she, her, you know, he, him, you know, more quote-unquote mainstream, whatever it might be. You know, and sometimes it was interesting. Some students, they, you know, they hadn't thought about it. Or, of course, there is a cross-cultural thing as well. If English isn't necessarily someone's first language, they might have to think for themselves, okay, well, from my language, those pronouns weren't gendered then, so then how does it relate to English? You know, so sometimes there can be those things. But again,
that's part
of it. Exactly, it's all part of it. Just in that we've talked about for the past, like, 45 minutes, you know, that's part of it in terms of language.
Yeah, going back to that, for sure, for sure.
But, yeah, so I was always insistent, and still am, about pronouns being included in introductions. Just because I think it's important. I think it's important to talk about. I think it's important to hold space. Yeah, just kind of get to know one another and not make it such that then it puts any one person on display or makes any one person exceptional.
Yes.
You know, especially because that was the issue I took with optional. If it were optional, okay, well then maybe those who pronouns are important to, or, you know, if they are
singled out.
Exactly, are singled out, and that shouldn't be the case. You know, it shouldn't. Pronouns can be important to some people and cannot be important to others, but, like, that doesn't mean we should hold space for both, you know? Like, and also it doesn't mean that we should support those whose, you know, if pronouns are supportive to them or not. But anyway, yeah, so, and, you know, more often than not, I have students who approach me or engage with me on that and are grateful that it is included in the conversation and things. So it's things like that in the classroom, and I think about it often in terms of didactics. So that is, you know, just the nature of teaching, the act of teaching, you know, how to make it a open space, how to make it a constructive and supportive and curious space. You know, like I said, I always try to check my positionality, but I think much of that is informed from queerness, is that, you know, trying to think differently and, yeah, things of that nature.
Yeah, I definitely agree, and I think it's a pattern that I saw with my previous teacher. Like, because we see figures, it's quite an interesting, analysis. So, first of all, you see teachers, I would speak for myself generally, as somebody above you in a knowledge sense or an experience sense.
Sure.
And my experience with the first teacher, I think she was like 23 when she was teaching us in high school. And I was like, wow, okay, first of all, this is a very young person, very accessible to the way that we, access knowledge.
Sure.
and conversations. And having somebody closer to my age being so uninstitutional that way, like dismantling this idea of a teacher being oh so powerful or the one and only giving the instructions or laying the boundaries for a conversation.
Definitely.
Was incredibly important. Like, we could do a presentation on, I don't know, one of the plays that we were discussing or analyzing. I think we did like Macbeth or something, and having presentations being written in like diverse language. I don't like saying inclusive because I think that creates an idea of like, we include you. There's still a power dynamic in the idea of inclusiveness.
Sure.
But I think in a diverse language, which is the terminology I personally like to use, therefore it challenged this idea of A, the teacher holding that space and power, kind of stooping to a level where we could both see eye to eye. I think her age played a part in it. There's also been older people I've interacted with, which are very present with using linguistics and queerness.
Yep.
And it's wonderful to see that, but I think having Alex visually a stereotype, as I would call myself, to more out of the norm, I would say, is very important, because it's like, not only can I exist in this world, but I can exist in academia. And I don't think that's the only place where resistance is needed, but I think a lot of conversations are held there. A lot of decisions are still held there. So it's important to see the people that are young or responsive to our ideas also create spaces for us to either resonate, disagree with them, challenge ourselves and themselves. So,
yeah. I agree. I think the classroom, I think the university, it should be a space for dialogue. It should be a space for conversation. Also, to what you said, you know, I agree. I try to present that way. I want to show up as authentically myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't do it consciously, but, you know, something, just as you said, like, or as we've spoken to, is just representation. And that doesn't even necessarily mean specifically, even in terms of sexuality or queerness or anything of that nature. But if someone is showing up as authentically themselves, then hopefully someone else can feel like they can step into that for themselves as well. Representation being important in that way, too. Yeah, I think, I don't know, you mentioned, again, the generational thing. Maybe this is tea, I don't really know. But in terms of this respective position, the role that I teach in, there is, I think, a preference to hire those who are early career academics, younger academics. Mm-hmm. The rationale is that we would then relate to the students a bit better, be it that we're close in age. And, you know, I think there's some truth to that. I think that stands to reason. That said, you know, I also think it's about effort. It's about openness. It's about being receptive to one another. Attentive to one another. So just, you know, just talking, learning from each other, right? I mean, that's something I intentionally say that, like, for instance, with all my classrooms, I consider them co-created, because we co-create the space together. I don't create that classroom. I may be standing in the front sometimes, or sitting on the floor, or I'm all over the place in terms of the classroom, sitting on the tables. but, you know, I mean, without you all, there there wouldn't be the
anything
classroom.
Anything to create.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. There wouldn't be anything to create. There wouldn't be a classroom. There wouldn't be that dialogue or conversations, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something to be said about that, you know, I just think that there should be openness across generations as well. And that's not to say every generation has had its own respective experiences and what we've also bared witness to, and mm-hmm. something that I really admire. I mean, at least in terms of the millennial, I was speaking from the millennial experience, like, yeah, it was, I don't know, it was transitionary, if you will, between sort of like that, what was it, Gen X that preceded us and you all and Gen Z, where it's just not such open dialogue or open discourse about certain things, to now where I kind of see mm-hmm. my students, most of whom are Gen Z, having open dialogue about these things. Yeah. And so the millennial kind of almost being the transition period? I don't really know how to refer to it.
Intermediate, yeah.
Exactly, like the intermediary or the, yeah. I even felt that in myself, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
like in the limbo sort of.
Yeah, you know, like in navigating that, the openness kind of coming to be or developing. Anyway, losing the plot a bit. But, you know, I think I was just speaking to that in terms of like, effort. I think effort, there's something to say about effort, about accountability, about trying to cross divides and differences, be it generational, be it ideological, pedagogically, epistemologically, whatever it is. It's just about, yeah, kind of holding space for one another and leading with curiosity. And I always say that in the classroom as well, you know, that I always try to put forth, I like it to be co-created, but I always put forth considerations, if you will, for my classrooms. Mm-hmm. And one of which is, you know, make mistakes. You know, to afford and acknowledge fallibility. We're going to be fallible, but, you know, also couple that with respect. If we can have respect for one another and lead with curiosity, you know, by the very nature of asking questions, then, you know, we can hopefully understand that we have the best of intentions and we want to learn from each other and we want to learn together. So, yeah, I don't know. I might have lost the plot there, but, you know, all very interesting to...
Yeah, to express, you know, like this is... I think that's what we try to do at SEC, at least this group. I personally haven't heard the episodes from previous groups, but we try to make it, you know, casual. You know, it's like you're sitting with us in a park, you're just not talking.
Hey.
You're talking in your head, you know?
Yeah.
You're just listening to us.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Well, thank you so much for that, Alex. Just before we finish, do you have any thinking points? I expressed mine throughout the podcast, but I want to ask you more explicitly that you would like, I don't know, a question to pose or a thought to put out there so our listeners can think about it from all ages, because I personally know I send it to everybody that I know. I don't know who listens to it. I know I've gotten positive feedback, but I just send it to everybody and their mother.
Yeah,
so.
Love that. Yeah, right? Listen, everyone and their guardians, for sure. Thinking points that come to mind really just relate back to just queerness in general. So, you know, I'd encourage anyone listening or anyone engaging with the podcast to consider for themselves or, you know, write in and share, like, what is queerness to you relative to your positionality, whether or not you identify as queer or not, and, like, how do you conceive of queerness? What is it? And how does it come to be? Like, how do you see or recognize queerness? I encourage this thinking, namely because this is what sort of I think underlines or serves the foundation considerations for queer theory. You know, just like, what does it even mean, and then how do we go about doing it? Because
mm-hmm.
I would also contend, you know, queer is not just as I said, language isn't static. Like, queer in itself is not like just a static thing. It's also something we do. Queerness is something we enact. So, yeah, that would, I think, be a thinking point that I would love to put out there. And what does it mean to be queer in this day and age, but also maybe even, like, spatially, like, because we talked a lot about social media as well. So, like, queerness as it exists, you know, in all these different spaces, and how do we transcend those? How do we move between those? How do we navigate it? How do we hold queerness for ourselves, but also how do we see or recognize it of it collectively? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think even relating back to the very name of the podcast is how can queerness afford us to be unapologetically ourselves?
Yes. That's a great way to end. I will have to ruin that great ending. No, I wanted to say, firstly, I guess my main talking point, which I'll sort of dig into conversations that I have in the next few days with people that I know from different languages, is how queerness is transformative, or, I don't know, seeps or exists in your own language and culture.
Totally.
That's my talking point. And before I say thank you to Alex, I would also like to say thank you to our dearest team. So Orly, Messiah, Matilda, because we got that wrong in the first one. And to Andrew, thank you for editing, for helping bring ideas, brainstorming. And lastly, thank you so much to Alex for, I don't know, sharing this space, sharing these ideas. This was more than I had imagined. I think it's great that we both, I don't know, we're able to share our own experiences and how that relates to our own lives and how that can relate to the lives of the people that are listening. So, yeah. Mm,
yeah, and I just want to reciprocate and say thank you for the invitation. Thank you for reaching out to me and including me in the conversation. I think it's so very important, especially now, that students and teachers be in conversation with one another and learn from each other. And, you know, very grateful to have this conversation with you. And also shouts out to the team. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Don't forget to listen to previous episodes if you're interested. Don't forget to check any more updates. The bio will have links to names, to resources. We'll decide that with the team at the end, but you'll have more to access if you are a first-time listener. If you're a first-time listener or you have any, I don't know, doubts or questions, you could also send them to the Instagram. We both hope you have a lovely day. This podcast was very long, so hopefully, you know, you can do some chores, do your laundry while listening to it, have a hearing session with your family back home. I don't know. Enjoy it as well, divide into two parts, and yeah, have a nice day. Have a very joyous day at a park if you can, just as us.
Stay cool out there, stay queer.
Yes. Bye-bye. Thank you.